Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. This is our official first podcast of 2018. I am still recovering from this blasted cold, so there's a good chance my voice will be cutting in and out even more so than normal. But joining me tonight is a longtime friend of mine. We met, oh my goodness, feels like a lifetime ago, way back in the year of 2012. He has since moved on to work at his own company, the Indie Bros, who specialize in doing PR, social media, and helping getting games released on Steam and various platforms. Please welcome to the podcast, Eric Johnson.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me on. Good to be your first podcast of 2018. Mm-hmm. And when I went to my inbox and saw our original email from 2012, you had just started Game Wisdom. It was like December of 2012. So that means that your fifth year anniversary had to have just been pretty recent. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. It's definitely been a long and tough process. We're just slowly but surely gaining Patreon support, but still trying to do what I do and get the word out about game design in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, we're still here, and that's, I think, more than half the battle.
So. Damn straight. But for those of you listening, like I said, Eric and I, we first spoke in about 2012. At that time, I think you were you exclusively dealing with Arkane Games at that time, or were you working with other developers then?
That's right. 2012 was, I don't know if you would call it a more stable time for me, but it was more individually focused time for me. I was with Arkane at the time. I'd come over from DIY Gamer, basically working on the indie or general games journalism side of things. Was one of the founders of DIY Gamer, which turned into Indie Game Magazine later, and eventually made the leap over into PR and marketing assistance for Arkane in 2011. With AI War and then their upcoming release of Valley Without Wind. Mm-hmm. And we went from there, and had a string of solid releases, but nothing that ever matched the success of AI War 1. Mm-hmm. And so here we are, more than 5 years later, and we are 6 years later, and we're working on AI War 2, which is something that I don't know if we ever envisioned doing. Mm-hmm. But the market has changed radically, and a sequel for that game makes sense to us, and we have the ideas for it. So we're working on that right now. I'm still with Arkane, as you know. Mm-hmm. But yes, Indie Brothers is now more of my main squeeze. We've been building that up now since 2016, maybe 2015. I don't know. It's been a while since we started. I mean, it just started as sort of a, hey, can we help out other developers beyond Arkane that we have befriended in the industry. That's how we ended up working with Netcore on Tales of Mahjong and their releases. Mm-hmm. And their subsequent releases since. And really, it was just to kind of keep us all in the industry. I did not have kids when I started in the indie game industry, and I have two now. And so the cost of living for everything has just gone up a little bit for me, and that's how it kind of went with Arkane, was that it's just going, okay, this isn't going to be quite enough, but I want to stay not only in the industry, but within the indie game sector, corner, whatever you call it. And so that's sort of where Indie Bros, the advent of it, was sort of came about. And then from there, we ended up working with a few other developers, notably Tim Keenan of Duskers, which was a very very nice launch for us, a very nice product to work with, and very, very awesome development team to work with. And that gave us some, I guess, some notoriety, or Tim did a great job of spreading the word for us, or whatever the case is. We started to get a lot more requests for assistance. And then we worked on RimWorld, and that also made a big impact for us as far as people knocking on our door and interested in working with us and partnering with us and all that. So it got to a point over the last couple of years, or last year in particular, where it's been more of a balance of figuring out, okay, who do we work with, and who do we give our time to, and make sure that we're ultimately giving them the best that we can do, and not take on too much at the same time, because we do have a lot of, it's a happy problem, I guess. At the same time, there is some illuminating things you get from all these requests and conversations and partnerships. And that includes a lot of, a lot of developers are nervous in this market. A lot of developers are understandably and justifiably worried mm-hmm. about how to move product in the current landscape.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that in of itself could be like an entire 2 to 3 hour cast right there on that one topic. Very recently, I spoke with Bill Gardner, who did the game Perception. We spent like an hour and a half, like part of our whole cast, just talking about how things have changed and how much riskier it is to make video games and try to sell them today. And going back to what we were saying a few minutes ago, Eric, like you said with Chris, I still need to get back in touch with Chris because we were waiting to see more what was happening with AI Wars 2 before we had him back on. But yeah, the times I spoke with Chris over the last 6 years, it was definitely very interesting to see how much things change, sometimes year to year, sometimes even just month to month when mm-hmm. it comes to making these games and, more importantly, making something that can keep your studio sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been something that you... as a developer or as a studio have to be very pliable with. You have to be able to, be able to make pivots and adjustments. This comes into conflict with what an indie developer is in general, which is I am just someone who gets a chance to do what I want to do and make my own game how I want to. That is out the window a little bit here as far as a commercial release. Mm-hmm. There's still the idea, of course, I think what you're saying is correct in that the risk is so much higher. I think the big thing is that developers need to assess much earlier if they have a viable product for the mm-hmm. market or not. And that's something that, it's being really critical on yourself. And that's something that a lot of people that's something that people struggle with.
Oh yeah.
Is to look inside and say, hey, is this really something that, we can proceed forward? If you look at the sheer amount of releases on Steam, you can see that a lot of these developers are not giving it these critical looks. Whether it's by choice or by design or whatever the case is. And that's a whole other subject, but the point is, I guess, is that you have to find some buzz, some sustainability to suggest to you that, hey, this idea that we have, and it's tough to just have an idea on paper or go all the way to a prototype and say, okay, I've gone this far with something. Do I now get the news from folks that's maybe not working out, and do I move on to something else? But that's something that I think developers really need to start considering earlier on in the process if they want to remain financially viable.
Yeah. And I think a very important part about that, as you just said, Eric, is at what point do you cut the cord? Do you say that this idea is not working, or do you say, let's go all in? Because it is very tricky to do that, because game design, as I'm sure you're no doubt aware of, is basically an iterative process. The idea where you're at, let's say, 2 months in could be very different from where you're at 5 to 6 months in. And as things grow and change, a simple project can quickly balloon out of control. Or you never know when that one magical moment of inspiration hits and all of a sudden your entire idea clicks together. And what makes things very troubling is just how the coverage of a lot of these games go. Because as someone who deals with indie developers and, again, managing releasing these games and getting the word out there, it can be very hard to, separate the noise from the signal when it comes to press releases and YouTubers and streamers and the whole deal. Like, a really good example would be something like Cuphead from last year. Cuphead was a game that was in development for, I think it's like 3, 4, maybe even more years. And these developers, they took a second mortgage out on their home to finance the development of that game. And when a lot of developers see that, they go, well, it must have been worth it. You know, we need to go all in on our crazy idea, and surely we'll make millions of dollars. But it never really works out that way.
Right. And I mean, I think, you know, you have to look at a situation. Cuphead had what, you know, I think there was originally a prototype with the boss battles alone was the was Cuphead's sort of coming out party.
Yeah.
And that was massively covered. I mean, they knew you get certain assurances when you get that level of buzz and attention.
Definitely.
Even if it's years down the road, you know, there's certain I don't know if you've heard of Megacurie by Mark Ten Bosch. He's been working on it for feels like a decade now. It's like a four-dimensional platformer. The idea is that you can sort of enter the fourth dimension and shift things around. It's incredibly interesting. But he won't release it. I think it's because he wants it to be, you know, just perfect and or just amazing and all that. And I get that. And when that game comes out, it will sell X amount of copies because of, you know, its history, where it's been at public shows, it's been at PAXs, you know, it's gained momentum in that direction. So, if you're a developer and you have a product and, or a game and it's really fun, but you don't have anybody around you telling you that or waiting for the release, then you're lying to yourself to say, hey, we need to be going all in with this product because we have a really great opportunity here. What you have is a really obvious opportunity to fail if you don't, you know, hit certain checkpoints.
Oh, yeah.
What you had mentioned before about, you know, how do you know? Well, that's what I think there has to be multiple checkpoints throughout. Like you said, it's an iterative process. So you, a good producer or however you want to, you know, label that, that job for the game design or game development process, a good producer is going to be on that every couple of months to see, you know, are we still within where, you know, the original design document has us? All games are different, but hopefully in most cases you can have some sort of trustworthy group of testers or individuals. And preferably like Arkane, where you have folks who really don't have anything else other than just their interest in the game to gain out of it. Because that indicates to somebody that indicates to you interest, right? Like you're not just getting somebody who's a friend or something. It's like somebody who's like, yeah, your game looks interesting to me. I'd like to test that. That's like a good early indication that you have something there, right? So if you're not getting that, then you have to be able to say, all right, we either need to make adjustments, potentially move on entirely, that kind of thing. And I understand, like, you know, there's points where it's like, this was on paper. Now it's prototypes. Now we have a vertical slice out of, you know, and it gets to the point where you put a lot of time and effort into it. I think looking at it as a learning process is a really good way to go about it. Understanding that failures are going to happen way, 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 way more than successes. And in this current market, you have to define what success means, because your ability to succeed as like the viral highest level is way less than 1%. Like it's way, way down there. Your ability to sell a certain amount of units to get you by and continue working as a studio, that's potentially more attainable. It's just more difficult these days. So you have to come up with, a really good plan, I guess, to go about it. You know, I want to say you want to have sort of a multi-pronged kind of plan, but it's different for every game. Each game has its own tactics, marketing wise and PR wise, that I think, hey, this is the best approach, or go all in with this. Like we're talking about going all in. You know, you see where success is coming from for any particular product, and you push further into that. You don't just go to places where nobody cares or there's no right, you know, there's no interest in. And that's how you cut through the noise. You mentioned that as well. How to cut through the noise? Well, you have to present your game to a niche or to individuals in that niche who are interested in it and care. And if you can't find them, then that's a good indication that you probably don't have a commercially viable product.
And continuing from that, as you said, Eric, that for a lot of developers, I think they do struggle with that idea of is it time to kill this project? And we see this in any creative industry. that people become very attached to these products, even or these projects, even way beyond the point of, you know, this is just literally not making money, nobody's interested in it, maybe it's time we move on to something else. And it can be very hard for someone to say, the last 5 months or even the last 2 years of my life, this is never going to work. We need to move on to something else.
Right. And I mean, again, that's where the learning process comes in. And you say, well, we take what we've done in the last 5 months to 2 years and we move forward in a way that's, you know, viable for us as a company, as opposed to the continuing this sinking ship method that we're current or a path that we're currently on. You know, I come from a background of being positive and optimistic. And that has served me well in some cases in the early going. It also has, you know, caused frustrations and problems and stuff when you think something's going to go one way and it doesn't.
Oh, yes.
So you need to know when to move on. You know, I think from a completely business perspective or you know, kind of that from that perspective, I would say that you get to game, because if you're talking about what you're usually talking about, you're talking about a game that has been released. You saw talking about a developer who has released a game and it's only gotten maybe a couple dozen Steam user reviews or maybe less, and it's just not getting any traction. That is where you really have to take that hard look and say, are we going to keep going forward with this? Because I've seen some studios continue to push post-launch content, and to the fans and to the players that own the game, that means a lot. It does. It makes a big difference to them. And the next launch, they've created a nice relationship with those folks, but it doesn't necessarily lead to more sales or lead to you making the breakthrough that you were hoping to make originally at launch that you didn't. And so if you love your IP, if you're in love with your game, like with your current game, your intellectual property or whatever the case is, and you launched it and it didn't sell very well, but you can't let it go, you can't move on, then from a business perspective, you need to do a sequel, because it's going to be so impossible in most cases for you to hammer away at the current release that didn't get the traction that you were hoping to get originally and get that back on track. You might be that outlier that, hey, this game did not launch really well on Steam, and it's just the developers just kept going at it and going and years, and now you get, you know, all these amazing articles on like Kotaku and stuff. But mm-hmm. usually that's not going to happen. That's not a smart bet to make. So if you cannot separate yourself from your IP, then come up with a sequel and make it better. And hype it better. If you think it's good enough, then hype it better the next time around, and, you know, see if you can get things going from that. It's definitely possible. I don't think that's a terrible way of going about things, but you also have to, you know, make sure that there's validity in your sequel, that's a reasonable thing to do. You know, you have those ideas, you know, all that, but, other than that, you know, it's good to have, most studios will tell you that they're prototyping multiple games, multiple ideas, always looking for, you know, no one's trying to ship at the same, like multiple games at the same time, but there's definitely a schedule to it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And excuse me. And when it comes to trying to decide, my speaker just went off for a second. Sorry about that. 3, 2, 1. Yeah, and when it comes to trying to figure out how to get these games, especially what happens after launch, I think that's another – I would say that's another really big change that has happened since we last spoke, like, you know, like around – like when we first spoke, I should say, around 2012 to where we're at now. Like back then, it was still considered that you release a game, it's done. You may put out a few patches for technical issues, but – more or less, that game's design is now finished. Today, as we've seen with the growth of quote-unquote games as a service, it has become a lot more about long-term support. And as you said, Eric, it can be very hard to know just how much do I put into this project. And to give you some examples, I can think of developers such as Skyshine's Bedlam, who had a disastrous launch, and it took the developer about, I think, like a year, maybe even more than that, to kind of do like a Phoenix from the Ashes with that game, or a second chance with a completely rebuilt version of that. But while that was certainly a great way of making amends to the fans, as you just said, from a business standpoint, that is just one of the things you really don't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you if it worked out in the way that the person, as far as, you know, financially for the developer.
I know it has helped them, but I cannot tell you if it's turned things around enough for that company.
Right, and no one can say whether them moving on or not would have made the difference for them. You know, ultimately, at this point, if you're in this industry for anything other than passion, you're probably going to get let down at some point. You're probably going to have a bad time. The ups and downs of this whole industry, that's something I think you have to be able to roll with. And that's coming from someone who has worked for several games that I've seen pretty solid success, a couple that I've seen, you know, pretty incredible success. But for the most part, I personally have never been in a position where like a high up indie developer that has been selling hundreds of thousands of copies each year or anything like that. Arkane has done that. But you know, it's something that I think, you know, there are the ability to be in a nice, amazing, well-paid indie development job, but it's few and far between. It's about, grinding away and you know, Jake Burkett of Gray Alien Games, someone is like, I always sort of follow on Twitter and I think he did the GDC talk of, how to be financially successful or viable as an indie studio with zero hits. I think it was something along the line of that talk. And he just, I think he hits the nail on the head by saying, hey, you know, there's so much coverage and so much, spotlight on successes. And it's so, cause I think it's so painful to talk about the failures personally for developers, right? So you just don't see that as much, and it's happening all the time, and people are grinding away. And I think that the people that are still in this industry, despite not necessarily having that viral success yet, or even finding complete stability, is because of their fortitude, their ability to adapt and move on and say, okay, this didn't work out. But they always seem to have a plan, and they move forward with that plan. So, you know, I think I think we make things a little bit too dramatic at times about it. You know, if you want to get in the industry, you know, being unestablished is a bad curse at the moment, but there's ways to become established without doing a commercial release. You can, you know, release a demo of what you're working on. You can release freeware of something to get some notoriety about who you are as a designer or a developer, going to and or participating in talks and panels, anything, you know, public like that. Can make a big difference for you. Don't just sit, you know, in your room and think it's going to happen, because that's pretty standard advice. That's kind of old hat advice, I think, is be willing to get out there, even though we're all pretty antisocial. So that's the truth of it, is that I think, you know, you need to establish connections, but you also just need to get a pulse of what's going on out there. And of course you want to be able to show people who could make a difference for you, your game, your product, what you're working on. Those people are going to be out there at those kind of events. So.
And I'm glad you mentioned Jay Perget a few minutes ago. I just spoke to him on a live cast, I think about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And that was like right around the time that Shadowhand, their latest game, was just released. And he was saying like he went overboard with that game to try and get it out. And that's always that very tricky part. And I think this is one I want to get your thoughts on, Eric, is, especially considering the fact that you've done so much with releasing games, is knowing when the game is done. Like with Jay, like as you said, he's an established developer. He's been doing this now for over a decade. but even he had trouble deciding when is this game ready to ship. And that, I think, is another major point. Again, there's a lot of major points that we're going to probably talk about tonight, and many more we're probably going to not have time for. But for a lot of indie developers, and this goes back to what we've been saying, that trouble of being able to think about things as a business. And it can be tough to say when this game is ready to go, because you really only get one shot at launching a game. And it can be, I'm sure, it can be very nerve-wracking to be sitting there going, is this game good enough? Or do I take another 2, 3 months, or even a year, and maybe it will be this much better? Again, it's always that up and down when it comes to game development.
Right. And I guess from my perspective and from the marketing PR perspective, I want to see momentum. I want to see heading in the right, you know, things heading in the right direction when you're heading towards a release. So from PR marketing perspective, if your game is feature complete, but doesn't have an audience or testers or any kind of buzz around it, then to me, we're still months off from wanting to run it out there. You can't depend 2012, you could depend on your platform holders like Steam giving you the necessary visibility. And I mean, there just wasn't the same kind of competition. It's not, this isn't Steam's, necessarily Steam's fault. I'm not trying to blame them. I'm rather just saying that in 2012, when you released a game, you could be assured on Steam, you could be assured of a certain amount of sales. That's not the case anymore, or visibility for that matter. And that can be really frustrating to developers as Valve has, as Steam has grown to what it is, as far as audience numbers and people who play, and understand that, you know, there's a lot of those millions that are playing one or two different games and stuff. And I understand that. But when you have millions and millions and millions of audience members as an indie developer, you want that platform. You want to just get in front of whatever percentage you can that fits within your niche or relevancy, you know, whatever your game is that you think, hey, this, or whatever kind of game tech you have that you're going, hey, I need to appeal to this part of this audience. And I know it's on Steam somewhere. That's been a huge fight over the last couple of years to figure out is how do we reach the people? Because if there's that many people on Steam that are buying games, then I just need to, like, as a developer, I just need to find a certain very small number of them to be interested in purchase the game, and I'll be financially successful. And yet that's like a major, major problem. So, with Shadowhand, Jake knows that he always has a tough sell with those kind of games. They're nothing like Solitaire whatsoever. They look like a single player card game, by visual cues and screenshots and things of that sort. So he knows he's always had that uphill battle on that. And, Jake comes from a, casual game development background where I believe he's had as much or not, if not more revenue come from, platforms like a Big Fish, versus, Steam itself. As far as, I do wonder, I mean, what, you know, his thoughts. I would have to ask Jake, or, you know, you have some secondhand information, but from him, but the idea of how, what he put in the extra stuff he added, was that based on testers telling him? Was that based on him wanting to add those in, him and Helen wanting to add those in? Positek and Cliff Harris published. There's a dynamic there to, you know, wanting to be on time and get the game out on time and to a certain extent. And with all that, I know that those guys are keen on getting timing right and all that. So, I don't necessarily have an answer for you on Shadowhand other than just that, you can plan everything just right and it can still go wrong.
Oh, yes.
I don't necessarily, I'm not sure where Shadowhand is in sales. I expect it to be a niche hit like his other games have been. Well, you know, a hit is a general vague term, but my point is that his games are good. They're fun and they should sell enough for him to stay in business. So, you know, hopefully they find what they need to, but it's a tough, you know, it's that kind of game is tough to show off in streams and YouTube necessarily sometimes. It can, those are kind of things you have to take into consideration. It's like, okay, like if my game doesn't do well in a certain arena, do I hang around in that arena and try to get people interested in it? Or do I move on to other places, to find the interest? Yeah. But again, I don't want to speak for them at all because I know that they're doing their due diligence over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going back to what we were saying a few minutes ago regarding the idea or not having that PR or that marketing built into a game, I think that's another major part that a lot of indie developers struggle with. Again, as we said a few minutes ago, most websites will report on the successes and not the failures. So you'll hear about Darkest Dungeon or Five Nights at Freddy's or Minecraft well after they've already become established and they're making that money. Again, it's that a positive feedback loop of the rich getting richer. Once you become established, once a major YouTuber mentions you, it just kind of spirals out of control from there. But a lot of developers, I think, still think that if I just make this game good enough, I don't do any PR, I don't, you know, deal with social media, anything like that. If the game is just great, I can put it on Steam or at least on my own, and it will sell. But that's really not the case anymore. And one of the things I think we've seen, especially over the last few years in particular, is that you never really know what game is going to strike that chord with people. I mean, the last few years, we've seen, again, Five Nights at Freddy's, PUBG, Stardew Valley. Like, these games just seem to come out of nowhere for a lot of people, and then the next thing you know, they're being mentioned on every major website.
I think marketing and PR, you have to think about it in two ways. There's the technical aspects of it. I need to gather X amount of influencers and press contacts and reach out to them about this, relevant to my game, preferably, obviously. I need to have this social media plan. I need to have this many posts and all that. But before you even get to that, obviously you need to make sure that you have a product that, or a game that's going to go over really well, in those spaces. So if you look at your game and say, what are my hooks? How do I sell this to, an individual, say a traditional press site, writer or reviewer, who's just being bombarded in 2018 with hundreds of different requests. And, you know, how do I stand out? And the answer is, you know, you have to look deep into your own works and see what you think is really unique or what you think will turn heads. And say, no, this, we need to stop what we're doing and we need to look at this game and we need to talk about it. If you can't readily define that, that's a big red flag, that you're going to have struggles commercially unless the mechanic is just, you know, amazingly awesome. But even then, like a great game we've seen great games with poor PR and marketing all over the place and they go by the wayside, unfortunately. So. It's just going back to seeing, establishing, I have an audience here. I have a following. When I don't wait to do my Steam coming soon page until a month before release. I do that a year before release and I do Steam updates and I see that I'm getting 45 likes and 12 comments on each of my posts or whatever. You need to look at those metrics. And be really honest about yourself. You need to look at that data and say, is this suggesting that we're heading in the right direction, that there's excitement building for this game? Or is it just sort of a few people saying, oh yeah, cool, I'm throwing you a like, or there's just a very small amount of interested people. And then the other advice is always, I think, stop trying to go too far outside your current audience, no matter how small they are, and just focus on them, make them happy, continue to give them things that make them just say, this, developer is awesome. This game is amazing. And we need to continue to talk about it and test and those kind of things. So, you know, it's, and you can do all those things and you can get all those indications, and things still might not necessarily work out depending on, you know, what your expectations are and how you set them. So, I don't know. It's a lot to take in, and things can still go wrong, but, yeah, I think there are indicators if you're willing to look and really be honest.
Now, I guess as a kind of a segue from that point, Eric, what, one of the things that we've seen from the independent side, at least from developers who have become established, has been more of a readiness to really go in different directions. For instance, Clay Entertainment, each one of their games have been a completely different design. Someone like Supergiant Games, between Bastion, Transistor, and Pyre, have been completely different. And this is a very interesting thing about independent games. I think this could probably fill its own cast. But one of the things that I've seen, at least from this end, is that indie developers tend to go more towards unique games rather than iterating on games, where it's the opposite when we talk about the AAA market. I guess, would you agree with that, Eric?
I do. I think it has shifted over the last couple of years. As I mentioned, we're making, at Arkin, we're making a sequel of AI War, which we would not have done if you asked me 5 years ago. And that's, I don't think that's it. I mean, if I need to clarify why we're doing that, it's because, you know, we wanted to continue building AI War out for a decade, maybe 2 decades. I don't know. You know, the idea is that we could just continue making AI War forever, like any other, like a Team Fortress 2 kind of game. But, it became clear that every expansion we released, we still had our core community, but it was harder I think you have to keep building your base game audience upon every content release. Otherwise, I don't think you're heading in the right direction there. And so with AI War 2, I think we're making some changes that make sense for that absolutely are like, that's a sequel change, and that makes sense to go from 1 to 2. But a lot of those things, I think we were hoping could eventually work out for 1, if 1 kept building financially like it was. So the sequel to us is just like AI War 1. It's a continuation on what Chris Park, you know, started, and what Keith Lamoff he's Arkin's other designer and developer and a programmer, and then all of the testers and everybody else who has put in you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours, not into just playing the game, but into thinking of how to come up with new AI, and to, you know, how to challenge the player. You know, that's all there, and that's all coming along into AI War 2. So, but then I also work for Netcore, and we have Tales of Majael. It's the same deal. We're figuring out, okay, how can we keep a game that is released, that has a release date on it on Steam that says 2012. How do we keep that going in 2018 as we continue to release new content, both, free and DLC? And you know, it would be our choice not to move on to a sequel. It would be our choice to stay there on the original. And then, so going back to what you had, said with Clay and Supergiant, they are in good positions, because they can, and they've earned those good positions, by the way. They have put themselves in a financial place where they can take those experimental risks and go different directions. Because of their past successes, they've added to their already stellar teams with more stellar individuals that bring in, you know, new, very different ideas. They're very diverse. Those teams, as I know and as I understand them, are very diverse and continue and appreciate that diversity and continue to add to that. So just by that definition, you're going to come up with some of those, or by that process, you're going to come up with new, kind of extraordinary ideas. And then lastly, if you have the financial backing to do so, you can do more market testing, right? You can see, you can spend money to actually viably see if this game is going to work in the current market. And there's a lot of different ways to go about that. There's not just one, you know, person you walk up to and give money to and say, hey, show me if my game's going to work or not. But there's a lot of different methods you can go about that. And there's professional companies that can that make a big difference to, I think, AAAs, you know, AAAs and even indie, big, you know, big indie studios like that, that they're looking into. We want to release a game that fits within, you know, their design, the mold of their designs, but it, you know, they are very, aware of the financial or the market, you know, the marketability of their games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I'm regarding that in terms of growing or trying to improve on these games, this could possibly be its own tangent, but I think this could be the best time to ask this now to you, Eric, is another thing that I see a lot of indie developers do is when they do make these unique games, they tend to be very rough, very inaccessible in some aspects, be it from a UI design, control scheme, or even just simply in terms of quality of life features, like being able to have subtitles, key remapping, and so on. And as someone who's done playtesting and has worked with these developers, I guess, what do you think about like that kind of challenge of, again, like thinking of your game outside of just you, being able to say, okay, here's my game, but what do I do to make it more appealing to people who aren't me or who aren't my five closest friends?
Right. And there's no playbook, right?
Yes.
So you, but you get those, I think you get those expectations established as you start branching out or putting your game through exposures with individuals and groups. If you go show at just a local event, someone's going to come up and say something sort of off the cuff negatively that might hurt at first, but you're like, they're kind of right. Or you'll say, you know, they'll point out something that they're, you know, why don't you have this? And you'll realize, and you'll smack yourself in the head because you've been working so hard on everything else, but you completely dropped that this is an obvious thing that you need in your game. This is why it's so important to, I think, work in teams, not put yourself on an island necessarily, and also, you know, be sharing publicly to some extent. You don't obviously want to give away everything about your game. You don't want to just give away your game to everybody or anything like that. But there is a certain amount of openness that you want to have as you're growing your game. That's part of your marketing and PR. It's really the start of it. That can kind of clue you into, okay, this is what people are digging about the game. This is what people are not liking about the game. And also, here are some things that I didn't really think were a big deal, but people are like screaming about and clearly need to be addressed. And I think that's how you go about, you know, it's just standard testing, whether you go out and go put a demo up on itch, or if you have forms or whatever the case is, if you don't have a pre-established group from like an older game or whatever the case is, then establish a group somehow, find a way, and get it done and get people outside of your general, like you said, the group of five friends, giving you some input, you know. And trust me, there's enough people that, you know, it's all perspective based. So you have to take an opinion and, you know, with a grain of salt and all that, but their perspectives, all those different perspectives you get, even if some of them are not necessarily the nicest folks, you can get a lot out of that. You know, and then of course, just look at other games, look at other successes. And you don't want to copy everybody. You don't want to like just do the same thing. That's been proven to not work, mm-hmm. But look at what good games do right and make sure that you're not messing that up, you know, horribly. I think that's an important thing. And again, this is all pretty obvious stuff. It's just, I think anybody in this industry, not just developers, can get a little tunnel vision with what they're working on. So, you know, mm-hmm. keeping at least a variety in your and your eyes and ears is pretty important, I think, for your own design and, you know, development, product development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I was talking to developer John Brieger a few times, and we've talked about the importance of playtesting. And as you said, Eric, being able to get your game in from as many eyes as possible to see what you might have missed. As a very interesting story, I remember speaking with Tim Keenan like a few years ago, and this was either midway or near the end of Dusker's development. And he said that basically, thanks to his playtesters, he caught something that he would never have spotted as a problem until way after launch. And this was, again, because people were tearing apart his code and looking at it and examining his game. And, excuse me, and the same thing you could really say again about Arkin's community and fan base. I've been on the Mantis tracking system. I've seen your forums, and you have people who will just, you know, tear apart every aspect of your game to see how things work and see there's anywhere you can make improvements.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And then the flip of it is that you also get just amazing suggestions that you didn't think you would never, that you would never have come up with on your own. And that's why I think it all kind of ties together, the pre-release, you know, community, because you're going to improve your game by getting other perspectives and making sure that you're the strongest perspective and making sure that those ideas work as you process and refine and put them into your product. You want to make sure that you're not just taking obviously any idea and every idea, but, you know, taking that and then you're creating a fan base. You're creating people who are interested. The word is evangelist, basically. It's just someone who's just in love with what you're doing, what the game is. And those kind of folks are always, to me, undervalued, because they were undervalued before when the market wasn't insanely busy, and they're undervalued now. Mm-hmm. You need people who want you to stay around, who want you to make games, or who want to play your game. You have to have folks like that. If those folks aren't there, and it's just all this business talk and pencil, it's just not going to work. You need to see that there is a love or appreciation for what you've been working on. And if not, you know, you have an ability to take it and make sure you've kind of checked all angles on it. And we've talked about it before. You know, we talked about within this podcast. You have to decide when to move on.
Yeah, and speaking about, again, knowing when to make these changes and so on, what you just said regarding your fans making suggestions is, I think, that's another very tricky point about game development, especially for any first-time developers, is how malleable should my game be? Because at the end of the day, you as the game designer are, you know, the Pope, the King, and the Church, in a matter of speaking, of what's going on in your game. And in a perfect world, you could spend, you know, 5-10 years putting in every suggestion people ask. But again, most people don't have infinite money to put into a game. And there's always that push and pull between, do I make these changes or do I keep to my original vision? I guess, again, with your experience and what you've been working on, Eric, I guess, how adaptable should a developer be once they start getting all that feedback from their testers?
Sure. So, I mean, it's certainly a thing of, you know, you need to have, I guess, limited ego, or I'm not sure how to define it, but your ego cannot be so much that you're not willing to take a look at an idea, possibly put it into the game and prototype it and test it. I guess ultimately there's no simple answer to it. You just have to look where the successes are. So if you see, well, not even successes, you have to see where the noise is, right? So if everyone is requesting for this feature, if it's not just one person that gives you the idea, but one person maybe presented it and you have a whole truckload of folks following them and saying, yes, 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 this needs to be implemented. Well, then you have a little bit more validity to potentially implement it versus just someone giving you a random idea without a whole lot of interest behind it. That said, you could have a ton of people interested in something, an idea, and it sounded great on paper, and you put it in and it just totally doesn't work. That is, I think, pretty typical. So to me, it's a question about, it just goes back to being, you know, being able to improv and say, okay, this is working, this isn't. So if you try an idea and that people are like, this would be a great idea and it works, then you have some momentum there because you put that in and the players are like, this is awesome. And you sort of, you build something up from that and you kind of keep going from there. If it doesn't work, you have to explain and hopefully they have, you know, they don't have to accept, but hopefully they accept that it's a great idea. It's a great, you know, or it was a great thought, but it just doesn't fit, with what we're doing in this particular, maybe it's half the time the ideas are developers will say, oh, that's a great idea, but we can't do it pre-launch. We'll have to think about doing it post-launch. That's like such a common occurrence. So, the bottom line answer is you have to face the realities of your budget and, you know, feature creep is something that's always going to be hanging around a design or development project. So you just have to be open to what folks are saying and then be really, you know, stable and reliable when it comes to parsing that information and saying, okay, this is reasonable or a great idea or whatever the case, and we should put it into our game and go from there. But, you know, it's all about seeing the data from that or seeing the reactions or whatever information you can get from after implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think one last question regarding that point of topic, and then I think we'll probably move on to another set because I know we are approaching about an hour into our recording right now. But the last thing I kind of want to talk about with that topic, Eric, with you, is again this sort of again goes back into the PR side of things, but that is being able to talk to your consumer. Because I mean, again, this is another topic that could fill its own podcast right here. But one of the things that we've also seen, and as you said earlier, you said several times regarding the infamous, you know, developer just like he's in his own personal cave for 2 to 3 years of development and nothing happens, that we've seen developers who've had trouble dealing with consumers, be it, you know, talking down to them, being rude, or even developers who have just made – who essentially blacklisted themselves thanks to just going all out on people on Twitter or on Steam or whatever. And a part of that, again, is, as you just said, when it comes to giving that kind of reception or responding, is we've seen some developers say, no, I'm not doing that. That's a stupid idea. You know, screw you. But I guess my question for you, Eric, is do you have any advice or anything to say regarding, I guess, trying to keep things trying to think of like the right term to use, I guess, be more like a negotiator or a diplomat. There you go, being diplomatic to your consumers.
Right. Well, to me, what you just described are artists who don't want to be salesmen, mm-hmm. right? So they want to create, but when it comes to selling or dealing with customers, customer service, all that, they want no part of it. Or if they are involved with it, the results are bad, are poor. So, I mean, if you're speaking like just to developers about, hey, what you should understand about yourself, some developers, you know, are great mm-hmm. at this. And, you know, these are the folks that maybe, have taken what they've already done in their earned successes, but they also figured out how to do Twitter right, things of that sort. You know, you're just going, man, that's such a benefit for them. And they know it and they work that. But folks who folks that don't know how to communicate, well, they better know that they don't know how to communicate. Because if they don't, that's when you end up with the people blacklisting themselves are going nuts on customers because they were unaware or ignorant of the fact that that's just not how you respond. And that's tough because, that's saying that the customer plays the game on a different set of rules than you do. And that's always been true from a salesman in this and a customer perspective, is that the customer is always right, right? So they can absolutely lambast you and yell at you. And you have to be able to take that and go through it. And if there's any shred of reasonable discussion, or that's a good point, or whatever the case is in there, you can take that and you can respond to that. You know, there's no point in responding to people that just antagonize or, that are just mad at something that you maybe is out of your control. But, I think it's just being a mature enough human to just say, I don't have an emotional reaction to you getting upset at my product, because that is something that's pretty normal. When for any artist that releases any kind of work, you have to expect different kinds of reactions, positive and negative. So that goes back to me being in theater class, you know, people are going to, not everyone's going to love what you put out there. And going back to what I mentioned about knowing yourself as a developer and knowing, hey, I'm up to the task to going on the Steam community hub or whatever forums or whatever the case is, and responding to individuals. If you're not up to the task for that, then you need to find someone else that is. And, you know, that's something that I don't think people necessarily think about or include in their budget, is having, it's basically a customer service job, and it's being responsive. It's being, you know, it's, you can call it a, there's community management, social media management, all that kind of, that, I think those, all those kind of fit under that. But it, I mean, you have to have folks, if people are interested in your game and talking and asking questions and talking about the game, you definitely want some sort of developer presence on there. It doesn't necessarily have to be the developer, especially if that individual is tough to work with, or is someone who is likely to respond poorly to criticism of his work or his or her work. So, but it's about thinking, hey, I need somebody to fill the gap here. If it's not me, then who? And you need to consider hiring someone for that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I mean, that point right there, we could probably dedicate an entire cast to, with being able to get people who can help you with where you are lacking in those areas. But doing a quick time check, we are definitely over an hour in, and I know you have to get going probably in the next 20 or so minutes. And again, there is so much more we can talk about. And as I said earlier, or while we were off recording, if you're free, we can certainly have you back on for a part 2 or 3 at some point in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to join you again, of course, Josh.
All right. So with that said, I have one final question, I think, for this part, and then we'll kind of, I think, segue into a few other different topics, and that should take us to the end for today. So you brought up a really good point in that last part regarding developers who are artists and not businessmen or not marketers. And this goes back to a very big topic that we've talked about many times here on the podcast. And I'm sure you can agree with this one as well, Eric, that for a lot of indie developers, or even just developers in general, there's always been that two minds between being the artist and the businessman when it comes to working in this industry. As I'm sure you're no doubt aware of people that you've worked with in terms of indie development, there are plenty of developers out there who they don't care about making money. They don't care about having a popular community. They don't care about making sure they're up on social media. They just want to make the game that they want and, you know, damn the consequences. And for a lot of those people, they feel that if you start looking into social media or start publicizing your game on Facebook, or, you know, as they say, you know, heaven forbid you get someone to help publish your game for you, they feel like you are, quote unquote, selling out. You know, you're selling to the man kind of thing. And I've spoken to a few developers. One of my favorites is Z from Serenity Forge about this topic, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. When it comes to that kind of divide, you know, the businessman, the artist, I guess, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think there is a divide, or do you think it's really just about trying to combine these two aspects into one successful element?
Yeah, I definitely think it's the latter. I think that if you're in the mindset that selling games is scummy, I mean, there's definitely been that thought for a long time from a certain corner, and that's fine. And as you said, if they're willing to accept damn the consequences and they're willing to accept that, then, you know, they should be in a good spot, and it's not really a big deal. Now it's when they start complaining and saying, hey, I'm not getting enough sales, mm-hmm. and that's not okay, that you're saying, okay, now you guys are, to me, that's an immature approach to what you're doing here. And this goes back to being aware and accepting of the current market, mm-hmm. is the artist always, it has to start with the artists. It can't start with the businessmen. I don't think it doesn't work that way. It has to start, I mean, at least with the designers and developers and the creators, the artist part of you has to be what starts everything. But if you're not letting that salesman, that businessman side in this current market, that's a huge mistake. It's a risk that is just not smart to take. And what I mean by that is, you know, being what we've been talking about the last hour, being open to change, being open to being malleable, being open to being open, I guess is what I'm saying. You can still be stubborn. It doesn't mean you can't stick with your design, and stick with what, you know, core design elements you have. But like, people look at some of the titles of these games, you're going, this is really not intelligent at all from a marketing perspective. Like, maybe title isn't even the most important thing. I read, Tom Francis, one of his tweets, talking about how it's just as important to get a good short description or short descriptions that people were inevitably going to use to search for your game when the title doesn't come to their mind. And he mentioned something for like Heat Signature and Gunpoint. If you actually go to his website for Heat Signature, I'm going to make sure this is the case. It says Heat Signature, a game where you can go inside the spaceships on his, on the title of the page. And that shows up, of course, in Google. And so that's the kind of, Tom Francis is a really intelligent guy, and that's the kind of stuff that the little details that you need to be taking into consideration now is accessibility, mm-hmm. not just within your game, but how are people going to find your game? Accessibility, when your game is going to run off the new list in hours. If you're lucky enough to get some kind of featuring, that's going to be shorter lived than it used to be. It may be a bigger blast in certain cases, but it might not last as long as you expected it to. It's just, you got to have those kind of things in mind. You can't just go 2 months before your game releases, oh God, we gotta get something together here. And unfortunately, that's kind of what my job is working with developers a couple months before their release and them going, oh shit. So, it's certainly not optimal. It's not an optimal situation to be working in that, under those constraints and with so little planning or, so little forethought going into it.
Mm-hmm. And this, I think that brought up a really good point. Again, if we want to, we could probably spend an hour on this one alone, is that when it comes to both the success and failure of these games, it really is, the devil is in the details. There are many little things that add up to making sure a game succeeds, just as there are many little things you can mess up on that can lead to it failing. As you just said, Eric, one of the most popular ones is literally waiting like a month or two, or I've heard some cases of people like waiting like a week before the game comes out and says, hey, can you do our PR campaign for us? Like, it only comes out in like 5 days. You know, it's easy, right?
Right. And it's, you know, just not, that's, and that just goes back to just not being in touch with the reality of the market and that. I think the reality of people and how people work, you know, you have to have empathy with the fact that 9 out of 10 people that you contact are probably not going to drop everything they have. 99 out of 100 people are probably not going to do that. So you have to have that in mind, when you're going out and reaching out to people. And of course, people say it's too hard to write a personalized pitch or things like that. Well, that's a load as well. You need, it's everything out there is a skill-based kind of thing, experience-based thing, and you just need to spend time doing it and improving on it. And like you said, there can be little things that you do that might screw things up, but you can't worry about that kind of stuff. You have to continue to get, you know, experiment, move forward, push forward into where, into down avenues that show results and success.
Mm-hmm. All right. I guess to switch gears, there's a few more topics we're going to be talking about relating to indie game development, but we'll probably be wrapping things up, I would say, probably in the next 10 to 15 minutes, more or less, if that works for you, Eric.
That's fine with me. We'll, you will definitely want to finish the other 8 to 10 hours, I think, that we plotted out now for the rest of our podcast.
Yeah. And again, I'm sure we'll have enough for several more parts going down the line. But here is an interesting question for you. I mean, if we're not careful, this could probably take up the rest of our time. But one of the more popular arguments that I hear, or popular debates I hear from a lot of people, besides just the usual, you know, are video games art? Is esports a thing? And so on. Another one is, what does it mean to be an indie developer? And again, I'm sure this question could either be a very short or a very long answer for you, Eric. But when someone asks, you know, what makes someone an indie developer, like, how do you respond to that?
I probably would have responded differently like 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Right now, it's a label I just don't care about that much. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean a whole lot to me, as far as there's not this – I'm not saying that I'm not prideful or anything like that, but I don't have to roll that out there. It doesn't make me one thing or the other to say – I'm an indie game developer versus a game developer versus whatever else you'd say versus a PR marketing person for games. Nobody outside of the industry knows what I do anyway. So that there's that. But honestly, I haven't really had this conversation with anybody for years, to be honest. So I don't have a pulse on it necessarily, but from the way I feel about it is I don't even care to get into the semantics of defining it. I think that, you know, if you're getting to create something without major influence by publisher, so I still think that, you know, an indie game can be an indie game if they have a publisher, if that publisher is a publisher that allows the game developer to do what they do, right? Maybe for me, it's defined by the fact that once a game is irrevocably changed because of a marketable, kind of a market reason or a publisher reason. I'm trying to come up with something here, but thinking of, you know, games like Xenogears and Fallout 2, both of those games are two of my favorite games of all time. And both of them were released way before they should have been because publishers were like, you have to release them now. That's where, to me, it gets to a point where you're going, okay, this is not being independently developed anymore. This has now left the hands of the developer and is being controlled by someone else. Now, whether you want to get into, I mean, you could talk about certain AAA publishers that allow their certain developers that kind of freedom. So I don't think that readily defines it either. I'm just saying, like, from my perspective, that's what I kind of care about. Is if the product itself is being influenced by anybody else other than the creators, then maybe that, to me, just that can, you can take the indie label off at that point. But beyond that, like, you can work in your house, you can work on a team of 100 people in a big fat office. It doesn't, there's a lot of different ways to go about it, especially in 2018. So,
all right. Now, I guess moving on from that, again, there's so many more things we can talk about, but I think these last two, I was going to ask you more thoughts about launching a game and such, but I think that would probably be its own topic at this point. I think we could probably say that for a part two.
Okay.
So, to wrap things up for this week, since we only have a few more minutes left, I want to get your thoughts on two more things that have kind of changed for being an indie developer over the last, I guess, 6-7 years at this point, what it means to work in this industry. And going back to what we were talking about earlier when it came to playtesting, I want to get your thoughts on the rise of early access, because this is another one of those big things we've seen kind of just like come out of nowhere for a lot of indie developers. When we first spoke in 2012, it wasn't really at that point. And then, of course, things kind of went from there. We've seen early access, green light, and the like. So I guess for you, Eric, what do you think about how early access has changed what it means to be an indie developer?
Well, early access itself has changed the market as much as it's changed being an indie developer. So when you think about early access, I think about its timeline. When it was originally released, it was very popular. There were certain releases that skyrocketed, did really well. And I'm sorry, I just received a call and it distracted me for a second. So let me get the 3-2-1 on here. We're going to talk about, bring me back one more time.
About how early access has changed what it means to make games.
Correct. I'm ready when you are.
All right. 3-2-1, go.
When early access kicked off, there were a bunch of games that went skyrocketed, sold really well. So, of course, there was a large contingent that followed the money and said, okay, we have to, you know, rearrange our schedules and let's do an early access release instead of whatever we had originally planned, an alpha or beta privately, and then the 1.0 release. And then consumers got wise to getting ripped off after it happening again and again and again. They finally, I think, did get wise to a point where they were releasing an early access game over the last few years now has been a completely different thing for developers versus what it was before. It's much more of a challenge now. Players, potential buyers, are much more discerning about whether or not they're going to buy it at this point. They'll most likely just take a pass or a wish list as opposed to buying in right away. So if you're a developer looking to go into early access on Steam, and you're expecting a lot of sales benefit from that, and you don't have a whole lot of pub going on around your game heading into that early access release, I would be prepared for an unpleasant surprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's become its own, very much its own business for a lot of developers to do early access. And again, like, there are some major pros and cons to it, and that's another topic that can fill a podcast or two. But it is very important to know what games work for that model and which ones don't. And as we've said over the course of this whole cast, it's very important to be able to plan these things out. You can't just go on early access and say, we'll release it, you know, sometime in the next 3 years. You need to be thinking about what am I going to be doing while this game's on early access? And again, how do I keep that momentum growing? Because if you lose your entire fan base like halfway through early access, that doesn't bode well for when your game is released.
Correct. Those are all great points and all correct and spot on. You have to know that early access is where it is on the timeline of your 1.0 launch, at least relatively. And just because they're going to want to know that, your players are going to want to know that. But additionally, I think you have to work the early access release and have that be part of your momentum building with PR and marketing. So, you know, I think that you can go on to early access on Steam without a whole lot of momentum going into that. If, like you said, you have a plan to get it to 1.0, and you early access can be something to work in your favor towards building momentum towards a 1.0 release, especially with the way things have changed. Because it used to be, I think, people used to, and you may have heard, may have heard this, but you only get, you said it earlier, you only get one mm-hmm. launch. Well, I think that the current state of Steam, and I don't know this for sure, but you get less visibility now during early access than you get on your launch, and you get more visibility on your 1.0 now. And that's a change that has not super recent, but fairly recent, comparably to 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, where if you released an early access and it didn't really go really well, then you could expect to not really rebound for 1.0. I think that there's, you know, obviously if you launch a stinker of a game, that's that. But if you have a viable early access product that doesn't necessarily take off right away, but has a stable building, audience, that you can consider yourself, you can consider that you still have a chance there when you get to 1.0, to get the exposure and hopefully and potentially the sales you need.
Mm-hmm. And again, like, there's so much more we could go into about early access by itself. And that includes his last question for you. And again, for those of you listening, this is just the last in terms of what we have time for today, but there's still plenty more we could talk about in the future. But as my last question for you tonight, Eric, regarding kind of like, this cast has kind of become kind of like the state of being an indie developer, I guess, is our main topic. But another thing that has certainly exploded over the last 6 years has been mobile games, especially for indie developers. It has become its own massive business. And again, this is a topic that we probably don't have enough time to get too far into tonight. But from your own perspective and working with developers as well, what do you think about the state of the mobile market when it comes to being an indie?
Well, it's always been to me a lot scarier than PC, although I have seen PC moving closer towards, you know, that kind of same anxiety that I get from the mobile market over the last couple of years. And that's because I just think there's a lot riding on platform relations and featuring when it comes to mobile games. You can do all those right things that we talked about with PC, Steam releases, and, you know, console releases for that matter as well. Building audiences, having them get interested, but it really seems feast or famine for mobile devs in terms of if they're able to reach certain lists and thresholds and algorithms on Apple or Google Play and get, you know, the featuring and that kind of thing they need. We work decidedly less with mobile games than we do with Steam releases, but in my experience, how we go about things pretty much the same way. We're looking to connect to the influencers that use the platforms that we're operating on, and we think, hey, these folks have an audience and would likely have an interest in our product. But as far as I guess mobile releases in 2018, to me I know it's evolved and I know things have changed, but my vision of it is still pretty stagnant, which is to say that I still see it as very monolithic at times and hard to solve as far as from a sales perspective, as from an indie developer perspective, if you don't have footholds already, specifically with platform holders and relations with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, again, it's a topic that we could easily jump into any number of sub areas when it comes to being a mobile developer, monetization, again, discoverability, and the like. But we are hitting about 6 o'clock my time, and I'm sure you have to get going in the next few minutes, Eric. So we will wrap things up for tonight. I guess my final question, or actually two final things to ask you, Eric. The first one is, I guess, for people listening to this cast, are there any places you would like to promote, like they want to check you out, check out Indie Bros, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm pretty boring, but if you want to follow me, I'm on Game Connoisseur on Twitter, and our website is theindiebros.com, which if you're not a developer interested in help, then there is probably zero reason for you to go there. But if you're interested, those are those are a couple of places. And thanks for letting me ramble.
Not a problem. So I guess with that, my final question for you tonight, Eric, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to end the cast on?
I'm going over my notes right now. A couple of things that I wrote down that let's just throw them out there at random. Risk of failure is greater than ever. So mitigate not being a smash hit. Be honest about how many sales you'll need to make and decide if it's reasonable to hit this based on what kind of interest you built up to that point. Find out before you get too far, if you can, if there's commercial interest in your game. Let's see. Be critical. Ask why people will stop to care in a time where they're being bombarded by thousands of good games and millions of less than good games. Why are they going to stop to care about your game? You really need to answer those questions before you move forward. And something we can talk a little bit when we talk about launching. Timing is critical, both in terms of lead times and what else is going on around your announcement or your launch. Don't let yourself get caught just being ignorant about something that you shouldn't have been ignorant about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's the list. Yeah.
And again, we could probably turn pockets in each one of those things as well in the future. But I think with that, we will wrap things up for our chat tonight. And again, when you're free next, Eric, we can always talk some more.
Awesome. Thanks again, Josh.
Not a problem. So, with that said, we are going to end things here for this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Again, Eric, thank you so much for coming on. The best of luck with Indie Bros. And like I said, let's try and plan to do this again real soon.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Not a problem. So, for those of you listening, we are going to end things here for tonight. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom and what I do, there are currently several options available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site, or be a future guest on either our live or record casts, be sure to check out Submissions Wanted on the front page. Again, if you like talking about game design, I can spend an hour or more easily, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBlazer for updates throughout the day. If you like support Game Wisdom through Patreon, we have our Patreon at patreon.com/GWBlazer. You can get access to our private Discord channel, ad-free versions of our live talks, and much more, as well as adding more content if we hit goals. Any donations would be greatly appreciated. And be sure to check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily videos on design, design topics, those live talks, and much more. So, with that said, thank you for tuning into this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week. And I will talk to you again next time with more discussions on the game industry.